made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Wachovia Securities, 1605 South State Street in Champaign. Wachovia starts with your life and plans your money around it. More information is available from Jeff Van Buren, Senior Vice President, Investment Officer, at 351-8694.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Think of gardening and you may very well picture a place of beauty and serenity. Is that why, in the midst of war, people create gardens? Landscape architect Kenneth Halfhand says gardening in wartime and in war-torn environments is an act of defiance, an attempt to create normalcy in the midst of madness and order out of chaos. Kenneth Halfhand, author of Defiant Gardens, Making Gardens in Wartime, is our guest in this portion of the program. His book is about gardens tended by civilians and combatants in the 20th century, from the trenches of World War I to the deserts of Iraq. Kenneth Halfhand is a professor of landscape architecture at the University of Oregon in Eugene. He's the author of several books. His latest, Defiant Gardens, Making Gardens in Wartime, is published by Trinity University Press. Professor Halfhand, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here.
Would you describe for us at the outset here the pair of stereoscopic photographs depicting a garden in the French trenches you discovered some years ago?
You're describing actually the picture that actually began this line of research.
Yeah.
It shows, it's subtitled Shelters with Gardens Behind in the French Trenches. And it just shows several soldiers standing by their kind of earthen dugouts with a few blasted trees by them. And immediately adjacent to that are some very, very modest vegetable gardens. And if you know something about the history of the First World War, you know that on the opposite side of that was essentially the horrific and hellish landscape of no man's land. And it was that picture that actually I had on my shelf for years that and made me think about it, and the kind of ideas about it festered, and I eventually decided to kind of examine it and the ideas behind it in more detail and look at gardens during wartime.
Yeah, one of the striking things about this photograph is the little fencing that has been built around one of the garden plots.
Right. Well, that's a common habit in French and certain European gardens. What those are actually is just twigs. You take a kind of willow twig, you stick it in the ground, and you upend it. We do this now with metal to make a little rail or border around the garden. And the gardens, when you look at the picture, are incredibly modest, something you might find in someone's backyard. But their meaning is dramatically magnified by being in the context of a wartime environment.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting that, you know, you would think that in this instance, even though this is a very modest garden, it's going to provide physical sustenance, but then also to take the time, you know, out from war to make that little fence.
Well, I think soldiers there were obviously trying to grow some, you know, fresh vegetables for, you know, food at the front. They weren't starving. They were adequately fed generally there. But I think the meaning of the garden goes much beyond just the food that they might be growing.
Yeah.
For them, particularly the soldiers in the First World War, I think anything growing just represented life in this environment where death was omnipresent and surrounding you and a daily occurrence. Anything that was organic, anything that was live, anything that was green was offered people a different kind of sustenance, psychological sustenance.
Yeah. Now, a few pages after that, there's an amazing photo of the Western Front titled Battlefield of the Somme.
Mm-hmm.
This is a landscape in ruin.
Right. Well, if I think a lot of people know the history of warfare during the First World War, but there was a front that went over 500 miles across Western Europe, and it was a narrow band, this kind of long linear band. But as many authors have noted, it's probably one of our kind of formative ideas of an apocalyptic or hellish landscape in the 20th century. Literally anything in the no man's land, the line between the trenches, was not alive. I mean, any living thing, kind of human, animal, trees, was just blasted to death. So in that environment, anything growing, anything that was deliberate, anything that was alive and human, you know, took on a kind of magnified meaning. So these gardens that soldiers made, and importantly, they made them on both sides of the line. These were made by French, American, and British and German soldiers, carried tremendous significance for these individuals. Yeah. And they write about them in their memoirs, in their diaries. All the evidence that I talk about in my book was based on entirely people's first-person accounts, either diaries at the time or memoirs that people, you know, wrote, obviously, subsequent in their lives.
Yeah. Was that something that surprised you to find so much? I mean, or is that the case that there was so much written about?
Yeah, actually, it's a very good question. It surprised me greatly. I mean, I had this picture, and I looked through the kind of standard histories of the First World War and the pictorial histories of the war and other places that I studied, and I saw almost nothing. But then when I started looking more seriously, looking at diaries and especially looking at photo archives, where I was doing my research, I found much more material. And then one thing would, you know, I'd find a photograph and know where it was and then look at information about diaries of individuals who'd been in those places or those battles. And this was a phenomenon that was not for everybody, of course, just like gardening is not in peacetime, but for those soldiers who engaged in it or those who witnessed it, it carried tremendous importance. So, yes, I was surprised.
Yeah.
The ones that were most surprising to me were I investigated gardens built in the ghettos under the Nazis during the Second World War. And when you even just kind of mention the fact that there were gardens in the, you know, like the Warsaw Ghetto, people are amazed by that fact, even those who kind of know the history, the horrific history of the ghettos well. And in that instance, I found much, much more than I ever imagined.
Yeah, that is a very moving part. The entire book is very moving. But in the part of the book where you write about the gardens of the ghettos, it was interesting and horrific to realize. You say there was a conscious effort on the part of the Nazis to seal off the Jews from nature.
Well, the whole process of ghettoization by the Nazis was first to kind of separate the Jewish community from the rest of Europe, really. Then it was essentially a policy that was a prelude to extermination, of gathering people and then systematically starving them and then leading them to their extermination. In the walling off and separating people from the community, when the boundaries of the ghetto were drawn, particularly dramatically in the Warsaw Ghetto, they intentionally drew the boundary to exclude any open space, any parks or gardens. The only green space in the ghetto was a cemetery. And that was an intentional practice. Even before the establishment of the ghettos, when the Nazis just instituted their anti-Semitic statutes, one of those laws was excluding Jews from parks and public open spaces. And there were signs that would say that. So that the kind of normal act of just walking through the street or going through the park or going to a playground was forbidden, and that was deliberate.
Yeah. There is one of the passages in this portion of the book, you quote a woman by the name of Gerda Klein.
Mm-hmm.
She's a young woman when the Nazis invaded Poland, and she and her family are held in the basement of their home, is that
right?
Correct?
Right.
And then she wrote that she had, before they were moved, she had to go back out to the garden.
There's several stories, and she's written a wonderful memoir and autobiography, and actually she is fortunately still alive. She survived. There's several stories. One is they were excluded, they were put out of their house, but before they were essentially, you know, deported to the ghetto, she snuck back in through the wall of the fence to the garden that was a kind of mainstay of her childhood, a kind of last glimpse a last glimpse of it that she wanted to have. And I've read other accounts of individuals who've done that. Later in the book, I report on another kind of remarkable story she tells. She spent the war in a series of concentration and work camps, slave labor camps. And in the last camp she was in, there was about 2,000 young women who were slave laborers in a factory. And every morning she recounts how they marched the women, you know, from their barracks to the factory. And they would go by what essentially was the commandant's house. And the commandant's house had a rose garden, and the kind of roses in it were essentially almost a kind of tease to her and the other women. But she knew that if they just stepped out of line to smell them or touch them, they would have been shot. But then she describes how one day on this walk, a crocus had burst through the concrete, and this line of women kind of marched in silence, kind of marched around it so as not to stamp out that crocus, that sign of life.
Yeah. I have turned now to the page where she writes about, or where you have quoted her writing about her garden when she was 15 and having to go see it one more time. She writes, "I had to see my beloved garden again. It had rained during the night and the young fresh grass was wet. I looked at the rich, moist soil under my feet. Everywhere memories surrounded me. On the old pear tree there was a mark made by a scout knife driven into it years ago by Arthur, her brother. Mm-hmm. There were the narrow, now overgrown paths where I rode my tricycle and wheeled my dolls. There was the little garden house, now badly in need of paint. We had used to paint it every spring." This is her home.
Well, in this investigation, the thing I was most interested in is what gardens mean to people. And one of the most profound meanings about gardens has to do with home. And particularly in wartime, both soldiers and civilians have made gardens either as reminders of home. A garden can remind us of places that we've been, or as a way, even in those difficult and horrible circumstances, as a way to try and create a home, even when it's a kind of a temporary one. And so our connections to home are this kind of on those two sides of both trying to make one, even though we know the place might be temporary, even hope that it's temporary. And at the same time, gardens are reminders of either the home we've occupied or homes even that we imagined. And we do that through the forms of the garden or even often just this kind of single plant that reminds us by its, form, color, texture, smell, of memories that have taken place in our previous homes.
Hmm. I have a friend who, she and her husband had to move, and she had just completed a garden, know. She had worked so hard on it, and she was heartbroken at first to realize that she'd have to leave it behind. But she told me, eventually I realized, I'll make another one.
Mm-hmm. Well, the wonderful, it's hard to reckon, if people don't think about it, but very few gardens outlive their makers. It's rare that a garden will kind of be sustained after the kind of original maker. And one of the other conclusions I kind of came to in terms of meaning had to do with the work of the garden. The satisfactions of labor are profound. It's just the sheer kind of knowledge of kind of marshaling materials and getting the land and seeds and monitoring your plants and propagation and so on, pleasures and pride that people take in that labor. And also, gardening is something to do. It keeps people busy, and especially in wartime when, or as a prisoner, your kind of mind is kind of occupied in thinking about horrible things. To think about something else, or just to take your mind off of something, was gratifying. And a lot of writers in their diaries will describe the pleasures of work even after a kind of day, as a laborer or as a day, spent, trying to gather food somewhere.
Yeah. There is an illustration that you've included in the book that is kind of an idealized look at a trench garden.
Mm-hmm.
It's an illustration, and the trees are blooming, and it's so domestic.
Right.
And there are these men standing around, and they have a pup.
They have a little puppy, and there's a little bust there and a sculpture, and that's an illustration from it's the Illustrated London News around 1915, in the kind of early period of the war. And it's it's clearly a very romantic image of the garden, and, and also probably a bit propagandistic, like, you know, how life, how nice life is in the trenches, and even it shows that tree there flowering as springtime. The actual images and the actual reality of trench life and trench warfare was much more horrific than that.
Yeah. But nonetheless, a garden like the one we first talked about at the outset of the interview, what would a garden like that have meant for the soldiers who tended it?
Well, I think it meant, again, a variety of things. One, I think primarily it meant something that was alive. And in this world of kind of omnipresent death, that was essentially. Second, it represents a reminder of home. Soldiers would write home asking for and requesting and getting actually specific seeds. And you have to realize in the First World War, most of these soldiers had an agricultural and rural background. Thirdly, dramatically, the garden represented hope. Essentially, all planting for I think, cultures from time immemorial kind of recognize or kind of the planting of a seed in the ground and its emergence out of the ground and out of the darkness into life, we take that as a symbol of hope. And you have soldiers who are hoping most of all to survive the conditions that they're under and to survive the war, and they hope for peacetime. And the garden, the plant, the flower, a tree, anything green could represent that. And also it's a reminder, it's essentially a reminder of peacetime. And the gardens were also about beauty. I mean, we speak of the ugliness of war, and the antithesis of that is something that's beautiful. And we find the world of gardens and the world of plants and the world of kind of human artistic creation in general to be beautiful. So it represented that as well.
Yeah. Why do human beings garden?
Well, I think one for all of those reasons.
Yeah.
I think all of those reasons contribute to it. It is something that is kind of essential to us. Just kind of two little kind of observations. Winston Churchill was interviewed by the British poet Siegfried Sassoon, very famous World War I poet who was actually a decorated and courageous soldier who then became an anti-war personage, and actually began the book with this little story. And in 1918, he interviews Churchill, who was then the Minister of Munitions. And in the course of that interview, Churchill says, "War is the normal occupation of man." Well, Sassoon wasn't particularly happy with that answer, and he went back to Churchill, and then Churchill added this remarkable caveat, and he said, "War and gardening." And essentially there, Churchill's talking, I think, about the opposites of war and peace, and violence and peacetime. But he's proposing that these are kind of archetypal human conditions.
Yeah.
The second is, at least in the Western world, the first garden that we speak of is the Garden of Eden, as the site of Genesis, the site of creation. And in the first commentary in the Bible, in the first chapter of the Bible, Genesis, about Eden, it says there was in the Garden of Eden was planted everything that was beautiful or pleasant to look at and good to eat. And that's really the first kind of commentary on the garden. And importantly, what's described there is that in the garden is everything that's good to look at, an aesthetic criteria, and everything that's good to eat, the pragmatic, the necessities of sustenance. And importantly, they're listed there as a pair. So it's both beautiful and practical, or beautiful and pragmatic. And gardens are always about both of those things. They give us sustenance in both ways. And I also like the fact, I mean, as a landscape architect, you know, good to look at is mentioned first. And in fact, many individuals, POWs, and people in the ghetto would write about kind of the garden, that it meant more to them than the food itself.
Mm.
That was the kind of just the beauty of it and the work of it meant more to it, to whatever kind of meager food they might have been getting from it.
Yeah. You suggest that Abraham Maslow might have missed something in his hierarchical description of human needs. Maybe you'd talk about that.
Actually, Maslow was actually a professor at Brandeis University, where I went as an undergraduate and taught there, and was a brilliant and magnificent man and psychologist and fundamental thinker. But Maslow proposes this hierarchy really kind of triangle or pyramid of needs where there's kind of basic needs need to be met until you reach kind of higher needs and then ultimately what he calls self-actualization and the arts and so on. At least in talking about gardens, and I think a lot of what I have to say about gardens in the book for other individuals would go equally as well for poetry or literature or music or the arts, that we don't have to wait for the kind of basic needs to be satisfied to engage in those activities. And in fact, for many individuals, those activities are equally life-sustaining. And individuals, again, you know, starving individuals in the Warsaw Ghetto, you know, were making art. Starving individuals were making gardens. Starving individuals, you know, were writing symphonies. There was a clandestine medical school in the Warsaw Ghetto. So I think, I don't think Maslow had it exactly right. Sometimes the pyramid's inverted.
Yeah. What do these gardens in these conditions tell us about courage?
Excellent question. I think, you know, we associate certain activities, especially in wartime, with soldiers, with courage and morale and the effort that it goes into to being a soldier. But courage is not something just defined or limited to soldiers. Civilians are courageous as well. And these individuals were often courageous gardeners. Their actions were acts of defiance. They were acts of resistance. They took amazing energy, sometimes literally at the risk of one's life. In the Warsaw Ghetto, there was a group called the Toporol, which was the Society for the Promulgation of Agriculture for the Jewish Community, which had actually pre-existed the war. And they gathered, when possible, with at least some kind of tacit acceptance by the German authorities, they gathered, you know, they appropriated any lands in the ghetto for growing of food and remarkably also of growing of flowers. Many people have asked me, well, where did they get the seeds? Well, one place they got the seeds was through smuggling outside the wall, under and outside the walls of the ghetto. And the smugglers in the Warsaw Ghetto were largely young boys who could, you know, go through cracks of things and go through sewers. And if those smugglers were caught, they were shot and killed. So the kind of courage to kind of engage in these activities was sometimes extraordinary.
Hmm. Tell us about the Japanese internment gardens. Here's another example of the garden expressing the aesthetic sense of people.
Sure. I think most people know the basic history that in the Second World War, actually today's the anniversary of Pearl Harbor. So shortly after Pearl Harbor, within several months, 120,000 Japanese Americans, largely those living on the West Coast, were relocated to internment camps, largely in the American West and a couple in Arkansas. Of those 120,000 Americans, by the way, 70,000 were American citizens at the time. And in these camps, which were located largely in away from population areas, in desolate, mostly desert sites, and they had about 10,000 persons per camp, individuals transformed the landscape of these camps. They were just bare barracks kind of laid out. And the Japanese American community, probably less well known in the Midwest, but where I live in the West, before the Second World War, that community was really the mainstay of the kind of garden and landscape design industry and business on the West Coast, in Seattle and Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. So you had a population of individuals who were incredibly skilled as gardeners and landscape designers. And there at the camps, and in this instance with not just the permission, sometimes with the help of the government authorities, they created gardens everywhere, where possible. So every barracks had a little entry garden. The mess halls where people had their meals three times a day had elaborate kind of stone and water and plant gardens. They created ball fields. There were victory gardens, ironically, during the war. There was even parks created. This was especially true at Manzanar, which was not the largest but the best-known camp, perhaps, in the Owens Valley in California, in Minidoka, in Idaho, in other places. It was attempted, but often the growing season was so short that this was difficult. And these gardens were gorgeous. I mean, they were beautiful. They were, you know, sites of artistry, but they also were dramatically sites of resistance. In a sense, in the camps, all official publications and documents were supposed to be in English. So, essentially, making these gardens was a way of kind of asserting one's culture in this condition. A kind of way of saying, you know, who am I as a Japanese American? There's a photo in the book of one kind of remarkable garden in Minidoka, which was in Idaho, at the edge of the camp, which was in just in this kind of desert, high plateau, sagebrush environment, where Amista Nita essentially bonsai'd the sagebrush, and by bonsai'ing it, essentially kind of made that into a kind of Japanese-American kind of landscape.
Yeah. There's also an amazing photograph, the Mess Hall Garden at Block 34 at Manzanar.
Right.
This is a sculpture garden.
Well, you have here, you know, a tradition of people who were, you know, both knowledgeable and skilled in creating gardens, and the materials of at least like certain styles of kind of Japanese gardens here, using particularly stones and water. Individuals used the stones that were available in the landscape, sometimes were allowed out of camp into the surrounding environment, literally to kind of gather stones up to, in some instances, up to a ton, which they then crafted into these remarkable creations. And if you go to, for example, Manzanar now, which is now a National Historic Landmark, where the National Park Service has actually excavated and kind of archaeologically documented many of these gardens, you see these gardens, or at least you see the kind of stones and depressions where pools had been. And if you start looking around, you see kind of evidence of gardens everywhere.
Hmm. Have there been efforts to preserve these kinds of gardens, and maybe to go back to them and to bring them back?
Well, in the internment camps now, both Manzanar in California and the Minidoka camp in Idaho, both of those are now National Historic Landmarks. Actually, this week, the Congress passed the bill making all of the camps kind of national landmarks, and we'll be doing kind of interpretive activities at all of them, although Manzanar is the main national kind of interpretive center. They have done, the Park Service is the administrator of these, though two of these now sit on Indian reservations. And if you visit there, several gardens, in fact, have been essentially excavated. So you can kind of see the pattern. And these are kind of large, you know, 50, 100-foot long, kind of what were originally kind of stone and water gardens. The stones are largely still in place. The plantings are, of course, kind of largely gone. And they are, in fact, discussing the possibility of actually reconstructing at least one of the gardens to demonstrate exactly what the life was like at the time during the war.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, landscape architect Kenneth Helfand. He is the author of Defiant Gardens, Making Gardens in Wartime. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Across time and across cultures, are there similarities and differences in the ways people have expressed their feelings about these gardens?
Particularly during wartime or gardens in general?
In wartime.
The ones I examined were all in the 20th century and up till now, gardens being created by at least American soldiers that I know of in Iraq and Afghanistan. Gardens always are a response to a particular environment. There are certain, you know, conditions in terms of climate, in terms of water, in terms of soils, in terms of vegetation. So the form and character of the garden is very much, you know, place-specific on the one hand. But the garden is also a cultural phenomenon, so they're also culturally specific. And there's certain cultures that have venerated and valued gardens more than others as an art form. So, for example, in the First World War, you have British soldiers making gardens, but Britain was then and still is very much a gardening culture. We could now be on a garden talk program in Britain. There's probably one going on right now. Mm. It's a culture where it's kind of garden knowledge is something that's very broadly shared amongst the population in all regions, and in fact also social classes as well. With the Japanese American community, you again had a community where the garden was seen and still is seen as a high art form, and its practitioners are recognized and looked at with pride, both in terms of their individual knowledge and their creativity. So you have those where it's valued. Then you have instances where essentially individuals are in a situation where the garden wasn't necessarily a kind of key element in the culture, but it asserts itself. I like to liken it to the fact, you know, we all have a friend or a relative who's, you know, they're just kind of nice and so on. And then in a time of crisis, they respond in ways that surprise us. And I think gardens are a bit like that. There are kind of comfortable, kind of congenial companions that we most often take completely for granted. But in time of crisis, the power of the garden and its possibilities kind of asserts itself in ways that we didn't imagine.
Hope and possibility.
Yeah.
Yeah. So across time, across cultures, the same thing is going on at the base of this. Is that spring will come again.
Yeah, I mean, spring will hopefully come again, and people plant gardening, and I know my profession as a landscape architect are incredibly optimistic acts. When you plant something, you plant it with the expectation that it's going to grow and mature. If you plant something that's long-lived, like in most trees, you plant it really with the expectation that someone, probably not yourself, is going to maintain it after you're no longer in that place. Kind of the acts of gardening are incredibly positive and optimistic acts that individuals undertake.
Yeah. At the close of your book, you quote an architect, mm-hmm. Jerzy Sultan.
Right.
He said that
Well, I can tell the story.
Tell.
Jerzy Sultan was one of the founding members of the SIAM, C-I-A-M, which was the International Congress of Modern Architects in the 1930s, the kind of founding collaborative of modern architects. And he told a story, which I heard him tell in a lecture once, that during the 30s, when Europe was in the grip of the rise of fascism, they had a saying, which was, how can we plant roses when the forests are burning? In other words, how can we do something that's beautiful and pleasurable and nice at the same time while the world is falling apart? And they then, importantly, answered their own question. And the answer was, how can we not plant roses when the forests are burning? Which was, I mean, essentially the forests are always burning. There are always horrible things happening, either locally or distant, and we're well aware of that, certainly in the contemporary world. But that doesn't mean that we have to kind of, you know, give in to despair. It doesn't mean that we have to stop planting roses, that we should stop doing things that are beautiful and pleasurable, because people need those things just as much as other things.
Yeah. I remember after September 11th feeling a need to go to the park.
In September 11th in New York City was a dramatic example of that. If you looked at in New York City where people gathered, they gathered in the parks, they gathered in the open spaces, they made shrines out of parks and open spaces. In Union Square, which was at 14th Street in Manhattan, which was as close as one could get to Ground Zero, and there's a photograph of this in the book, actually, that my son took. He was living just right near there in the city at the time. People created these elaborate, essentially, memorial gardens. And if you looked around the country, where in virtually every city in America people gathered, it was in those parks and open spaces. It was a really kind of reassertion of the necessity, really, for those democratic spaces for people to, you know, to gather together, just to be together.
Yeah. It also seemed that there was air there, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. It was literally open.
Yeah. You could breathe.
You literally could breathe. And in the city, when what was in the air was really horror, that was critical.
Very interesting. Again, this is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest, Kenneth Helfand, author of Defiant Gardens, Making Gardens in Wartime. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question, a comment, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. When I turn to gardening in my own backyard, sometimes it feels like I, too, am doing some defiant work. Because it is work. That's also part of it, and that is a good and rewarding work. Want to talk about that facet of gardening?
Yeah, and I think when we speak of garden work is different than garden labor. You know, if you're a laborer and in the garden is different, particularly than the garden in the kind of domestic and residential landscape, where the garden is often part of our leisure time and our leisure activities. Most of us now don't garden for sustenance, but we still do that. Almost half American households have a garden, actually. And surely people are growing food and they want that produce, but the satisfactions are much more than that. And I think that's critical to recognize. Even when people are growing it for sustenance, it means much more to them. And from my observation, one reason I was kind of looking at gardens and war was the same way that psychologists and philosophers and theologians have looked at people in extreme and difficult and horrible circumstances, and maybe it tells us something about the essence of what it means to be a human being, kind of some essential characteristics of humanity, that if we looked at gardens in these extreme situations, it might tell us something essential about what gardens mean to people. So I think there's a kind of germ of this in even the most modest garden, whether it's a kind of residential or public garden as well.
Yeah, I guess it's back to the idea a little bit here of Eden, of paradise, and our coming up short, but we're going to try.
Well, I mean, the fundamental kind of garden, garden idea is the Garden of Eden. The garden is paradise. The garden is a place that's peaceful and essentially and kind of all our needs are met. The opposite of that, of course, is hell, and war is a hellish circumstance. So that in those circumstances, when you're just kind of close to or kind of in a kind of human a hell of human creation, even the most modest garden has that kind of glimmer, if you will, of paradise in Eden. I tell you kind of two other kind of soldier stories. One. I was lecturing recently about the book at the North Carolina Arboretum, and I was introduced to a man named Dr. John Creech, who then tells me his story. He's in his 80s now, that he is, perhaps to his knowledge, the only American soldier he knows who won a decoration. He won the Bronze Star for gardening. Well, what did he mean by that? He explained. In the Second World War, he was a soldier in North Africa. He was captured by the Germans. Then was at a POW camp in Germany, and then a POW camp in Poland. At the camp in Poland, there was a derelict greenhouse, and he was a horticulturalist by background, got permissions from the Germans essentially to resurrect this greenhouse. He made it work. He got seeds from the Red Cross and the YMCA, grew food that helped keep his fellow soldiers alive, and for this he was decorated appropriately. The other is I have been emailing and corresponding with soldiers now in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And American soldiers have been creating gardens. And in the book, there's a picture of these two soldiers from the North Dakota National Guard, a Sergeant Justin Wanzak and a Sergeant Carl Quam. And Sergeant Quam, in writing to me, explained that the garden helped him kind of cope with missing home and missing his family. And what they did was they got seeds from home, were sent from North Dakota. They tried to grow these originally. They failed dismally at first because while they were farmers, they really didn't know how to grow things in Iraq. So they got advice from kind of local farmers and gardeners, and they grew things, and rather successfully, less for the food than really, the activity and kind of symbolism of it. And then he described what he called garden time. And for him, garden time was after a mission of really kind of patrolling and literally being in danger of your life and, bombs exploding around you, returning in the evening, where he describes it's 140 degrees, to then engage in work in the garden. In this garden time as some respite and some relief and something that enabled him and others perhaps to forget the conditions under which they were. And fortunately, he was now back home.
Yeah. What did he grow and what did it look like?
They were growing, at least the pictures I've seen, was corn. And there's this kind of wonderful picture which originally appeared in the the National Guard online magazine of these two soldiers in camouflage gear standing there kind of in slight mimicry of American Gothic, Grant Wood's painting, you know, standing there with some pride, you know, with their corn in hand.
Right.
And it was actually rather successful.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. We've got a call coming in, and we're running down on time, so I'm not going to launch into another question here. We're going to get our listener on the air to talk with you,
sure.
Kenneth Helfand. A listener in Bourbonnais, line 4, hi.
Hi, thank you. Are the residents of Baghdad growing gardens?
Good question. I have not been there. I'm not in the military, and I'm not a soldier, and I'm not a journalist as well. So I've not been there. I honestly don't know. I would assume yes. I mean, you have a culture that has, you know, Iraq has a kind of, you know, ancient gardening culture. And I'd be confident that I'm sure people are growing gardens, but I don't have any kind of direct evidence of it. I do have evidence of an internee, a prisoner in Guantanamo, of trying to grow a garden. This is a kind of on this side, where this was an article in the Washington Post not too long ago, written by one of the lawyers for the internees in Guantanamo, where a group of individuals had wanted to have a garden there, and they're not allowed to do that by American authorities, although, of course, they should be allowed to do that. And one individual had a 2-inch-tall lemon tree that he had grown from seeds from meals.
Mm. Okay.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
Next, we talk with a listener in Champaign on line 1. Hi.
Hi. I don't know whether you've dealt with this, but I think of a different sort of defiant gardening. I think of people who had a front yard of endangered plants, and it got to be a sort of a national challenge, and it got into Audubon magazines and the like and became an international challenge for this. There are people to grow endangered species in their front lawn. And I'm thinking of that, and I'm thinking of arboretums. And we actually have a little prairie in downtown Champaign,
mm-hmm.
Which is designed to let people know about an ecosystem that is very rarely understood in the boondocks.
Sure. No, I think, sure, I mean, the kind of defiance can actually be in many, kind of many, many forms. And certainly a garden that's trying to kind of demonstrate something or educate people or to preserve something, whether it's preserve a cultural phenomena or to preserve a biological phenomena in terms of indigenous and endangered species, they actually represent that. And or individuals, I don't know the specific case study you're talking about, who've, you know, let's say, have gotten rid of their front lawns and trying to, you know, have that return to grassland or prairie.
The prairie very much looks like weeds.
Because it does look like the weeds to individuals, and in fact they're not. But it represents it's a way of the garden representing a kind of assertive act towards the community, and in fact an assertive positive act towards the community, trying to demonstrate to it an alternative, let's say, to current planting patterns, and also a reminder of what the place has been historically.
It's interesting. I'd never regarded it as a defiant act.
Well, it's a positive and assertive act. I mean, defiance is not necessarily a kind of negative thing. I mean, defiance is something kind of assertive and positive in at least in those situations.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
You're very welcome. I'm recalling, I don't know if it's still there or not, but there is a garden at the state capitol in Springfield that is right outside one of the Capitol buildings in the complex there.
Mm-hmm.
And it is prairie plants.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a shock to come across it when you first bump up against it. And this is something that you also write about in Defiant Gardens. There's a certain element of, oh, my gosh.
It's, I mean, the prairie plants, of course, which are, you know, in the prairie are not surprising at all.
Right.
But all of a sudden you can place them there, they stand out, and they have a different kind of appearance. And in a sense, you almost see them for the first time.
Right.
I know the University of Illinois campus. On the campus, there are the morrow plots of their plots of corn.
Right.
Which, there's no lack of corn in the Midwest.
No.
But seeing it in the middle of campus, all of a sudden you see that, you see those furrows and that plant in a different kind of way.
Yeah.
And gardens do that. I mean, gardens are always places that are bounded, that are most often enclosed, that are somehow demarcated in the landscape. And that demarcation is really critical for our understanding of what they're about and what's contained within them.
Yeah, and thinking of the morrow plots, you have to, for listeners who might not be familiar with them, it's a relatively small plot or plots, but the undergraduate library was built underground so as to protect that.
Exactly. I think they're the oldest continuous scientific plot in America.
Yeah. Yeah. And well, we've got to break away here now to get the settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade and from Kansas City. And I'm sure Todd Gleason, who's going to give us those numbers, can tell us a little bit about the history of the Morro plots. He is with Cooperative Extension. And there we have to wrap it up. Kenneth Helfand, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank
this
you.
Afternoon.
It's been a pleasure.
Kenneth Helfand is the author of Defiant Gardens, Making Gardens in Wartime. The book is published by Trinity University Press. And that interview was from December of last year. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, Todd Gleason is here with settlement prices from Kansas City and Chicago.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade on this Wednesday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. The May wheat at 474.5, down 3 cents today, had a high price of 484.5, a low at 74. Once again, the settlement price at $4.74.5. They were down 3 in the May contract. July futures off a penny and 3/4 today, 498.5 the top, the low at 88, settlement price at $4.89. September futures there, 504 the high, the low at 495. And the settlement price at 496.5. They were down 3 cents in December contract. A 513 top low at 505, settled at 506. They were off 3.5. The March futures, $5.18 in the wheat pit for the high, the low at 512. Settled on that low, they were down 4 cents. From the corn pit on a Wednesday afternoon, May futures nearby contract up 10.25 cents today, 366.25 the high. Low at 51.5, a settlement price at 363.5. They were off 10.25. July futures, 378 the top, the low at 63.5. They settled a dime higher at $3.75.25. And September futures, 379 the high, low at 370, a settlement price at 376.25. They finished up 5.75 for the afternoon. December contract into corn pit, $3.84 the high, the low at 77, settlement price at 381.5, and they were up 2 on the day. March futures, a penny and a quarter higher at 391, had a high price of 394 and a low at 388 for the afternoon. May futures next year, 399.5 the high, the low at 94.5, and a settlement price at $3.97. They were unchanged in July futures, 403.5 the top, the bottom at 397.5, a settlement price there at $4.5. They were down 1/2. May bean meal futures 721 the high, the low at 714, and the May beans at 715.5. I think I said bean meal, of course, the soybeans.